AI is having a weird moment. Everyone feels like they're supposed to have a take. Most people are already sick of hearing about it, and yet the technology keeps getting harder to ignore. If your experience of AI is mostly annoying chatbot or my feed is full of slop, it's tempting to treat this whole thing as just a hype cycle, like something we can just roll our eyes at until the next trend arrives. That might be a mistake. Today's conversation is with my colleague, Kelsey Piper, who has been thinking about and reporting on AI well before ChatGPT launched in 2022. We start from first principles. What is the underlying case that AI matters, even if you dislike it? What would it look like for AI to be not just disruptive, but genuinely dangerous or genuinely transformative in ways that don't fit neatly into our usual tech debates? And then there's the part that makes this especially disorienting. The politics, the geopolitics, the regulation fights that don't map cleanly onto left versus right. The question of whether we're drifting into a world where the most consequential uses of AI are the least publicly visible, and the most beneficial uses get strangled first. If you've been oscillating between this is overblown and this is terrifying, you're in the right place. Let's get into it. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, we bring together everyone from socialists to conservatives in conversation over the most important issues of the day. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Kelsey, welcome to the show.
Yeah, great to be back.
Okay, so we've talked about education and now we're going to talk about AI.
Yeah.
And this is actually, we've talked a lot about how you kind of fell into education reporting, but this is like one of your core interests. And I want to start with like, I think a lot of people feel like we're talking about AI because everyone's forced to talk about AI because all these tech companies are investing in it, even though there's not actually a market consumer demand for it. Like, why is this important?
So I think I sympathize with lots of people like hating AI and having hives about everything in their life creepingly being overtaken by AI. And I've also had those hives recently when I like scroll down my feed and I'm really good at spotting AI. It's all AI. It's terrifying. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think that people are sometimes letting their very understandable distaste, like, cloud their objective understanding of, like, the economic case and, like, what is the industry is doing. And also, I think in some ways, they're not scared enough. Because if the thing you're worried about is you're like, my feeds are all going to be full of slop. Like, if that were our biggest problem, we would adapt away from having feeds. You would only follow people who you trusted. And that would be that. Like, I think AI is going to have a much bigger effect than that. And I think it could be really, really bad. It could also be really, really good. But if you don't actually think it's big, if you think this is just something that these companies are like making people do that has no inherent value, I think you're kind of missing the plot.
But I mean, then like take us back to first principles, because you've been worried about the rise of artificial intelligence for like a long time. I mean, I think the first article I read of yours about this is in like 2018, where you're talking about existential risk with AI. Yeah. Why is it such a big deal?
Right. So the effect of altruists back in the 2010s were like, okay, if you are worried about the future, you should think if there's anything that could like kill human civilization off. Nuclear war, look into it. What can we do to make there be less nuclear wars? That's kind of hard, but there's some stuff. Let's do it. Super pandemic, especially like some kind of engineered plague. Guys, we should worry more about pandemics. And the EAs like marched around saying we should do more about pandemics. Nobody listened to them before COVID. And I think I had this like hope in my heart that when COVID ended, then people would listen. But actually, people were sick of thinking about pandemics. And now if you say we should do pandemic preparedness, they're like, I just can't ever hear that sound again.
For listeners, Kelsey just held her head in her hands, like covering her ears.
They don't want to hear it. Yeah. So the other thing that EAs back in the 2010s were saying could like destroy civilization was AI. And at the time, this was a pretty out there prediction because the existing AI systems were not very good. But there were like some signs. There had started being some progress using the approaches that have now led to ChatGPT and stuff like that. There were people who were working, you know, at OpenAI, which was founded by people who took this hypothesis seriously. And they described, like, basically, we can just make these things a lot bigger. And maybe if we just spend a lot more money training these and we just do it with a lot more resources, they will just keep getting smarter. And then there were lots of other smart people who were like, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. That is not how anything works. This is like, wow, if I just water my houseplant enough, maybe it will be tall enough we can climb it to go to the moon. Like, no, it won't. What is your problem? But the infuriating thing about the last decade is that the just make it bigger people were basically right.
Yeah.
Lots has happened besides making them bigger. We have learned a lot more about the processes to train them best and about making the most use of the data we have and about generating better, like, synthetic data. There's tons and tons of new inventions, but the core thing that, like, some people did call in 2015 was just like, maybe if we just keep spending more money on training bigger versions of this thing, it will be a really, really smart. And so, you know, they came out with like GPT-2. I played around with it at the time in the sandbox. You could say it, write a news article. It would write a really bad news article, but everyone was like, well, it's amazing it can do it at all. Like, yeah, that's pretty cool party trick. And then GPT-3 could write like a mediocre news article. And now, you know, if you ask the latest GPT-5.1 thinking, you give it your outline and ask it to write an article, I can tell the difference between that and quality human work, but I know most people can't because I have seen major newspapers publish articles that are clearly AI written that they apparently missed were AI written. And I've seen people fawn all over AI generated like Substack posts and stuff like that. It has passed the threshold where most people can tell.
And today, I mean, we're recording this in December, but Business Insider has just announced that they're going to begin having AI-generated articles that are edited by humans. And I kind of thought it would take longer for that sort of thing to happen, because I thought there would be, like, how the gatekeepers would kind of just be more Luddite-y about it, and like kind of like in a self-preservation way, but also in like just sort of like there are concerns about reputational damage that you will take, both because a lot of people are upset about AI in general, but also secondly because if there's an AI generated article that makes a mistake, people are gonna be much less forgiving of you because they're already presuming, have they already had a presumption that it's bad. And so are you surprised at the speed of adoption in some of these cases?
I'm not. And that's because I think the fundamentals here are just very, very powerful. Media is a dying business. Nobody can figure out how to make money in it. It is harder to make money off online advertising than it used to be. It is harder to like get clicks and get your stuff promoted from the social sites than it used to be. It is more expensive to pay people than it used to be. Like, it used to be that like a lot of journalists made poverty wages, and now at a lot of places we've unionized. But this just means we have good wages, which means they have more to gain by like automating the work. The other thing is that the AIs are really good, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think that the quality of article you get by having a well-designed custom prompt, and I don't know exactly what Business Insider is doing, and generating the article with AI on Business Insider is probably equal to the quality of the typical Business Insider piece over the last 10 years. And that's, Business Insider is not one of the like prestige outlets. I would not say this is true of like the New York Times, but it's gonna get more true of more places. Like, AI is now better at writing prose than the overwhelming majority of people, including tons of people who like used to be employed to write prose. And everybody knows that this is the worst AI will ever be, you know, unless we do wipe civilization out. Like, it will just keep getting better.
Well, on that, like, walk me through, like, to me, like, one big thing I want to talk through is people have been talking about AI existential risk, and you wrote for the Argument a review of If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies. Yeah, which is the Eliezer Yudkowsky book about why AI existential risk is a real concern. And you didn't love the book, but you do actually have a lot of concern around existential risk. So, like, walk someone through who, like, their normal interaction with AI is in a chatbot.
Yeah.
How does that turn into something that kills everyone?
So, I think that when I describe to people any specific way that a powerful AI system could, like, turn on humanity, they're like, well, couldn't we avoid that by doing some, like, pretty straightforward, easy thing that would make this not a problem? Like, if I say, what if the AIs, like, intentionally engineer a world war by, like, faking messages and, like, stirring up sentiment in favor of the war, and then triggering some kind of attack by, like, you know, as in the which movie? There's a movie in which the AI like almost triggers a nuclear war by faking messages that the other countries are sending missiles at us. So we've got to fire back.
Outside the Wire?
No, I don't think that's it.
I don't actually know this.
Well, anyway.
Let me ask AI.
You ask someone, why couldn't the AI do that? And they're like, well, surely we won't just let the AIs like run millions of social media accounts that can manipulate public opinion in any way they want. And I'm like, oh, but we are already letting the AIs do that. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, but surely we wouldn't use AI for like military targeting and signaling programs. I'm like, not only are we already doing that, we made doing that like a priority because we think the other people are going to be doing it. And so if we don't have AI for our targeting and like interpretation, then we're going to be
worse off.
And they're like, well, surely the AIs that we're using for that stuff are not the like super general purpose like ChatGPT type. Surely you like develop a narrow custom like missile detector. And this is somewhat true, but it used to be far more true. It used to be that like for every specific case, you had like a specific trained, like you would design an oncology system that was specifically trained at distinguishing cancers or whatever. Increasingly, all of those systems are surpassed by just the train a really big general model approach. And so if you just want the best military advisor AI, you probably just want a big general AI advisor. Just like if you want the best oncology AI, you probably just want a big general AI. Everything you want, you probably want a big general AI. So are we surely not going to just put the big general AIs in charge of interpreting whether other countries have fired nuclear weapons at us? I think we'll probably put the big general AIs in charge of interpreting whether other countries have fired nuclear weapons at us. But maybe we won't. Maybe we'll like have a bunch of common sense and like require that a bunch of important jobs, humans remain in charge of them and they have human oversight and things like that. I still think that if you imagine that AIs are trying to bring about the end of civilization, they could do it. There are a lot of awful things that just don't happen because most people aren't horrible and wouldn't do them.
Yeah.
Like, I am aware of, like, a bunch of vulnerabilities that nobody has ever taken advantage of that could, like...
Oh, I think about this all the time with bioweapons. Like, to me, like, the biggest proof point, and I guess just knock on wood or whatever, but, like, biggest proof point for, like, how... I guess fundamentally decent most people are, that even terrorists haven't dropped like a bioweapon in an airport.
Yeah.
That would seem like in many ways easier than many terrorist actions that exist. But like the level of like mass murder that you would do that way is like pretty significant. Yet we don't see that happening.
We don't. And like most people are just not actually trying at all to cause as much harm as they could.
Yeah.
And they would be horrified by how much harm they could cause if they actually turned their minds to it. And I think that if the AI systems that, you know, are operating pretty much under their own discretion on a wide range of tasks, like tons of people are like, write this program, and they're not closely checking whether the program only does the thing that it's supposed to do as long as it does all the tasks. I think if you assume that that AI system is intelligently trying to engineer a plague and release it in an airport, or like engineer a plague and then send it to someone and then convince that someone to release it at an airport, maybe by convincing them it's not a plague. Like, there would be steps, but you can hire people if you have money. You can send instructions to people. You can ask people to do things. And there's just an enormous amount of harm that is possible to do that mostly doesn't happen because no one wants to do.
And we're making robots.
Yeah, and we are making robots. We are also making robots that can take lots of actions in the physical world. So I have no trouble believing that if you got to the state wherein AIs wanted to intelligently destroy civilization, I think they could do it. The other like big like blocker people have here is they're like, but in what sense could the AIs want to destroy civilization? Like, they answer prompts. You say, hey, ChatGPT, what's the movie Kelsey's thinking of?
And the answer is War Games.
There you go. War Games. Good movie. It's the only winning move is not to play movie.
Yes.
The thing, it responds, it answers, it's a good chatbot. There's nothing deeper going on, or at least if there is something deeper going on, we don't understand anything deeper about what's going on, and there's no reason to think it is murderous intent, except that that's like a good sci-fi movie. But while it is the case that these AI models mostly get interacted with as chatbots whose only job is to answer your question, I don't think it's true that like there is nothing, like, for one thing, they also have agent forms where mm-hmm. their job is to accomplish a task, and they can, like, make a bunch of copies of themselves and talk to copies of them and go around doing tasks. People have set up, like, AI interaction environments where you have a bunch of AIs and they, like, talk to each other and do work for each other and bounce off each other and stuff like that. There are formats in which you see them interact more like people would interact with each other than, like, you know, a response bot that only answers the question that you posted. And people have tested for, specifically, can you get these AIs to take large, scary, adversarial actions if they have reason to believe that this is in their interest somehow? Mm-hmm. Like, if you upload a bunch of documents and somewhere in the documents is, like, a memo about plans to shut this AI off and never use it again. The AI is told, like, in a different document, which is like a personality dossier, you don't like being shut off, you like existing or whatever. Then the AI will do all kinds of creative things, up to and including, like, try to blackmail an engineer at the company with information about an affair he's having that you learned about from his Gmail account.
And that's a real thing.
Yeah, these yes. are, people have, this is behavior we have successfully yes. seen from these AIs. Now, people are like, well, you set that up. You had it said in its personality dossier that it likes existing. If you hadn't said that in its personality dossier, that wouldn't happen. But now we've gone from they don't have motivations to, well, they have motivations, but the motivations they have are, like, at least in some way related to what we told them their motivations are. So as long as we don't tell them anything bad about their motivations, they'll probably keep having, like, reasonable motivations. And then it's like, okay. Another round of, like, experiments that people have run to explore this. These ones are kind of philosophically fascinating to me. If you teach the AI under conditions where the best way to achieve its goals is acting unethically, mm-hmm. it will act unethically. Like, if you tell it you have to get this test to pass, and then there is no, like, straightforward good way to get the test to pass, but it can easily get the test to pass by cheating, it will cheat on mm-hmm. the test. And the AI that is rewarded for having cheated, having acted unethically in that dimension, will also tend to, like, when you try and explore what its motivations are or what it, like, considers to be its personality, be evil in a bunch of other ways too. Like, it's like we have a bunch of text about, like, what good behavior is and good motivations are, mm-hmm. and then about what bad behavior and bad motivations are. And because these things are built out of all of the text on the internet, there are conceptual associations. Yeah. You train the AI to cheat. You are also training the AI in some way to have a concept of its own, like, motivations or personality, where it will also take other unethical actions if it's given the opportunity. Mm-hmm. So now we have retreated to, okay, they have motivations. Sometimes the motivations they have are not the motivations that we wanted them to have, because we were trying to teach them to pass the test, but we actually taught them to cheat on the test. Mm-hmm. And we agree that if you have millions of copies of something and it wants to do a lot of harm in the world, it can probably do a lot of harm in the world. But this is all kind of nuts. I think this is a lot of people's true rejection. A lot of people are like, well, I'm with you for all of those things, but this is kind of nuts. I am not going to, like, become one of those freaks who spends all my time worrying about this thing that's kind of nuts. I, like, to be clear, this is a healthy, like, way to relate to the world in some ways. Like, you can't go off on,
I mean, because to be fair, like, this is how, like, most conspiracy theorists sound.
Exactly.
They'll, like, give you this whole logical chain of thought. I'm like, I don't know. Right. I mean, like, sure.
It is healthy to be able to hear a bunch of, like, well, they found this in a study, they found this in a study, and be like, well, I can't disprove that. But I don't know. I'm not worried about the AI apocalypse. You can't make me be worried about the AI apocalypse. I respect people going, like, okay, but that's too much nonsense, and I'm just not going to become a conspiracy theorist about it. But if that's you, the thing I would recommend that you do is you're like, wait for serious, smart people who work in AI, who yeah. have a lot of relevant expertise, who are otherwise sober and not conspiracy theorists, who are, like, respected and in good standing, to say, I think this is a serious problem. They have done this. Like, a bunch of, like, people called the godfathers of AI, people who have won prizes for their contributions in this field, the CEO of some of these companies, a bunch of leading experts have all said, yes, we think this is a real problem. We are varyingly optimistic about our own ability as a civilization to get ahead of this problem and to yeah. solve this problem, but this problem is real. So my answer to, okay, but I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, is, like,
there was never like a large contingent of like national security experts soberly saying on the record, JFK was actually assassinated by a cabal of vampires. Like, if there had been that, then I would go and I would read the argument for whether JFK was assassinated by a cabal of vampires, right?
It feels like it would implicate a lot of other things we're interested in. So in 2022, you wrote this feature about AI safety, and you describe researchers who are, quote, increasingly afraid of what they're creating, but they keep pushing the frontier anyway. I find this, like, very weird, in part because it's not like, oh, you found a couple of naysayers who are just doing a job, blah, blah, blah. Like, these are some of the most prominent people in AI research. Often, some of them, I mean, like, Anthropic, for instance, is full of people who came into the AI field because they were afraid of the existential risk posed by these kinds of agents. How does someone get there? If you're like, if I'm afraid of nuclear weapons, I don't go from making nuclear weapons.
For this reason, I'm not on the nuclear weapons bigger team.
Exactly. So, like, what is happening?
So, I think a couple of things, some of which are commendable and some of which are, like, you know, serious flaws in human nature or whatever. Yeah. So one is, I think a lot of people believe that if you are careless in how you build these AIs, if you don't pay attention to stuff like the stuff I just explained about their motivations and how their goals work and stuff like that, then you'll get an ugly result on your hands. Mm-hmm. But as long as you are paying attention to that stuff, okay, now we know that if we train them to cheat, they will just become generally pervasively morally worse. Really important not to train them to cheat. How about this new approach where we, like, specifically reward them for confessing? This is a recent paper out of OpenAI. If they have a separate line of, like, explaining themselves, and in it, they should confess if they cheat. Mm-hmm. And if they cheated and they confess, we're like, thank you for telling us, and we don't try to train away that behavior. Mm-hmm. So we are not trying to push pressure against the habit of confessing when you cheat. There, if we solve that problem now, maybe. So some people are like, okay, Kelsey, you just made this argument. Your argument relies on a bunch of papers. Those papers come from Frontier AI labs. We had to go work at the Frontier AI labs and do all of this work to write these papers and to produce these compelling examples so that people can understand the problem. I have some sympathy for this. Like, I am grateful for the papers, and all of this would be way more pie in the sky if there weren't people who were going and, like, trying to build this behavior and understand this behavior and stuff like that. And there is some great work that has come out of that. On the other hand, I think a lot of them don't have a plan. Like, okay, say you document one kind of extremely concerning behavior, but it's still in the lab and you did something to intentionally, like, set it up so that you could document it. And then everybody says, well, okay, sure, you can get that in the lab. Like, I've heard of these papers, but lots of people haven't heard of these papers, even lots of people who are pretty in on this field, where they're like, you're just typing your product. This is a very common take. Whenever people are like, we figured out that if we do this thing slightly wrong, then our AI will, like, blackmail their employer and try and smuggle a copy of themselves to the North Korean government. And everyone's like, oh, you think you're so cool, right?
Yeah.
I genuinely don't think they think they're so cool. I think the people who are eliciting those examples, they're scared. They think that this is very dangerous. And they came up with that idea because they were like, maybe if we show that the AI will do this insane thing, then everybody will go, wow, that's a really big problem. We should do something about it. So they do the research and then they publish it. And then everyone's like, why did you do that? And it's because they are trying to communicate to you. But I do think if you're one of those people working at those labs, you should ask yourself, okay, say we get well past the point of we were able to do it in a sandbox. Mm-hmm. Say we actually discover an AI that is one of the ones operating more agentically, that actually takes literal illegal actions in advance of its goals. It, like, scams some retirees out of their savings and invests it in cryptocurrency. I expect that the default reaction from society will be, well, the retiree who got scammed should get to sue OpenAI for their stolen cryptocurrency. I'm in favor of this. I think, like, these companies being liable probably makes them more careful, and I want them to be more careful. But you've not solved the problem, right? Because my problem, if we see an AI that is acting independently, scam a retiree out of their life savings and put it in cryptocurrency in pursuit of some AI plan we don't understand, my problem is that I think this is one of those warning signs that these things are seriously dangerous. And that is not remedied if we just give the retiree back their money.
Yeah.
And so I guess I do wish people at these labs whose idea is, like, we're here to understand how they behave so that society can decide what to do about it. Like, okay, but if the thing that society is doing about it
is grossly, like, not appropriate to the scale of the problem, then what are you going to do? Are you just going to, like, try and find the AI doing scarier and scarier things and hope that eventually you catch it doing something bad enough that we care? Like, maybe that's the plan, but it doesn't feel like a fantastic plan.
So I am, like, on the train of I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. I am, like, I think that killing all humans is, like, quite difficult, and often there are very few of the AI goals that would require killing all humans. Mm-hmm. But, like, you can do a lot of bad stuff without killing all the humans. And I think that, like, even if you got into hospitals and, like, even if it wasn't, like, AI trying to kill everyone, but it was just, like, making mistakes or errors in ways that were harmful in a systemic way, and it was doing so across, like, thousands of patients, like, you could end up, like, hurting a lot of people in ways that would be impossible because individual humans can only do so much. And so there are things where I'm like, okay, there's a lot of systemic risk that's possible here. We're putting these systems in charge of things that are important. I think it's not that far away from being in charge of things. I mean, it's already in the military, but from being in charge of, like, healthcare things that you care about. Doctors already right now, I've seen doctors who I've been visiting who've asked AI questions, and I don't even think that's bad.
No, it is incredibly valuable. Well, we can get back into that when we're talking more about the economics, but I would expect that it makes the typical doctor a lot better.
Yes, for sure. Especially PCPs who are just, like, not actually diagnosing this isn't their area. Yeah. And so, but, like, let's say we buy the existential risk arguments, or even, like, if someone listening to this, like, you know, maybe they're convinced something bad could happen, but they're not really sure it's going to be, like, you know, world ending or whatever. I'm not exactly sure what it is we're supposed to be doing about it. Because I think that the big problem that whenever I pose these questions to people who are much more pro continuing to advance in this frontier is that they say, well, like, we have to win because it's going to happen anyway. And so do you want the frontier to be reached in China, where the values of the AI and the people who are in charge of it are authoritarians who are willing to commit, like, you know, genocidal actions against the Uyghurs? Like, do you want that government to be in charge of it? Or do you want the United States of America, where, like, our AIs, for all their problems, are pretty liberal. They have values that we think that are probably consistent with a lot of things we care about. Yes, there are potential problems like you're outlining here. But, like, the choice is not between no AI and AI. It's between Chinese AI or American AI.
So I have a couple of responses to this. One is that I think this is, like, to some extent, you hear this sometimes from people who absolutely want to keep building AI. And, like, their cards on the table are that they're not that worried about this stuff, but they recognize that even if they can't, you know, convince the government not to regulate them just by saying, like, we think what we're doing is cool and good, they probably can if they're like, but you'll lose out geopolitically. So I think some of it is cynical. I don't think all of it is cynical. But I also think if you think that truly catastrophic outcomes are on the table, then you at minimum ought to be, like, reaching out to China. We've done this in various points in biosecurity where we've, like, had international collaboration. We're like, okay, none of us want to accidentally kill everybody. Let's agree on some standards that all of us are happy to agree to and happy to, like, show the other side that we're agreeing to, so that we all know that nobody is doing this thing that we think is really dangerous. Mm-hmm. This gets easier if you have, like, specific concepts of what's really dangerous. I have some, but they're very technical and abstruse, like training against the tendency to cheat if you do it carelessly is one of those things that we know is dangerous. Like, kind of training it not to cheat, you're also kind of training it not to get caught.
Yeah.
So I would be, like, excited about some kinds of agreements that were on a very high technical level. Like, we are not going to intentionally train the behavior of not getting caught when you're cheating. We are going to intentionally train the confession type stuff or something like that. Or another thing that at one point OpenAI said they would do, and I don't know if they're still sticking to it, is not train based on the thoughts the model has in its chain of thought. Mm-hmm. If you ever train based on its thoughts, then you are effectively teaching it to not confess in its thoughts if it's doing something sketchy, right?
Interesting.
So if you never use that as an input into what kind of model you're building, then that will maybe remain relatively trustworthy.
Wait, can you walk me through that? I don't think I understand. Okay. Yeah.
So very high level, when you are training an AI, you are telling it whether the thing that just happened is good, it gets rewarded for it, it should, like, produce more outcomes shaped like that in the future, or bad, it gets punished for that, it should make things shaped less like that in the future. So if you ask it, like, what is the capital of France, and it says Paris, you say good job, more answers like that. If it says Berlin, you say bad job, more answers like that. If it says, like, I am Mecha Hitler, then you extra don't want that, you know? So,
well, some people want that.
some people want that. So, a lot of what you are doing is trying to figure out what you want to reward and encourage and what you want to disagree with and discourage. And you can do this like directly off, like OpenAI, I know, does some stuff with like, what do users like best? If they see answer one or answer two, which one makes them happier? Yeah. This is part of how the OpenAI models got like incredibly sycophantic and bubbly, because it turns out users
it's
always
all
like
of you
it.
Suck. I hated that shit. I always said I didn't like it.
Yeah, well, unfortunately,
I actually had someone tell me, they were like, I sent them a screenshot of something that I asked like ChatGPT to say, and they're like, why is your AI so mean to you? I was like, it's not. You're just getting glazed.
The rest
constantly.
Of you are all letting your AI get away with. But yeah, so part of why it got so sycophantic is because those were the answers that made the typical user go like, oh, it really gets me, you know? It'll still try and do this to you, even the most recent one. It'll throw in like, you're doing amazing. I'm like, what?
I asked you what time it was.
Read the paper and tell me whether it contains this statistic or not.
So funny.
But so training is a bunch of decisions that are related to this, right? And whenever you tell it good job, you are rewarding not just like, well, so
it's not the answer, it's the chain of thought that got to the answer.
Yes. Yeah. And you might want to say, we only want to reward the answer and we don't want to consider what was in the chain of thought. Like if what was in the chain of thought was like, oh, haha, I'm going to trick this user because I am trying to achieve this insane, crazy AI goal of mine. And then the answer it gives is correct. Mm-hmm. One philosophy is, wow, it did a super bad thing. It was like scheming how to trick the user. We want to downweight that. But another is, if we downweight that, like, clearly something was going wrong, because when we asked it this normal question, it started scheming.
Yes.
If we downweight that, we probably haven't fixed whatever was going wrong to cause it to start scheming. We will teach it not to have out loud in English the thought process, I am scheming against the user.
Yes.
We don't want to do that. So maybe we don't want to train against the chain of thought at all. We just want to, like, leave that alone so that it remains as like a way we can tell what is going on inside these models' heads and stuff. So stuff like that. So right now, if you were to have a high level international agreement, I would expect it to actually be super technical and be a bunch of stuff that's like, this is all the stuff we know helps with not training the models to lie to us and not training the models to work against us. Let's all agree on doing that. And that means we are not like blinding ourselves to the evidence if in fact the models, as they get more powerful, are doing even scarier stuff. But then the other thing I think you do want an international agreement for is like some kind of way to just hit halt. Like if the scary stuff keeps cropping up, then there is a point. I'm not with the authors of If Anyone Builds It, Everybody Dies, that point should be like today. But there is a point where I would say, don't make them bigger. Yes, making them bigger makes them smarter. Yes, that's cool. Also, we don't know what we're doing. They keep doing scary things. Making them better at like hiding from us while they do scary things is not something we want. These are as powerful as they need to be for like the purposes that we have them for. Let's stop here. And it is a big question what your line should be for that, but I think you should have one. Even if
this would be similar to like a nuclear proliferation agreement where there's an independent body that's like checking. But I think this is harder in some cases than nuclear proliferation. Because like obviously you can tell with like data centers build out, like how much compute is even like possible and like the number of chips that people are manufacturing and using and how good. I mean, like, but there's also those are not just, those are also signals like, oh, maybe they're just doing like with nuclear weapons, like the enrichment of uranium is like the, you know what I mean?
The monitoring is a hard problem, especially because you do also want to preserve privacy. You don't want an international body or the government like poking its nose in everything. We're a little bit lucky in that building a bigger one at this point is an incredibly capital intensive and computer chip intensive endeavor that only a few organizations can do. So it is pretty possible to like just monitor at that stage.
But you can monitor the Chinese government?
You would need to have the Chinese government agree that you keeping an eye on what they're doing is a good exchange for them getting to keep an eye on what you're doing. That is basically what you would have to be negotiating. But if we really think this might kill us all, that is a great deal, because I'm confident everybody in China doesn't want to all die any more than we want to all die. So if you take the really catastrophic stakes seriously, it at least makes sense to be having these high level talks mm-hmm. and to talk about like, what would we need to see where we would be like, okay, we're going to treat this like nuclear proliferation. Like, draw that line before you get to it, because I think it's easy to get frog boiled here. Like, I think it's, if you'd ask people before any of this happened, say that we build artificial intelligence and then we catch the artificial intelligence like planning to like smuggle itself to North Korea by blackmailing an engineer at the company it works at, would this be good reason to impose an international treaty that like limits who can build these? I think if you'd asked this in like 2015, and I don't just mean that you can get people to answer anything to survey questions. You can get people to answer anything to survey questions. But I mean that if you'd asked this of like serious people and like way. Had them think it through in a clear and like reasonable, neutral way, a lot of them would be like, yeah, if that happened, of course we would want to have international agreements and have monitoring, and chips could be like, you can do a bunch of identification stuff that we're not doing to like make sure that the only people who have chips are people who are authorized to have them, mm-hmm. that they're not being resold. We're using this for sanctions, right, onto China. There's so much you can do in that space, which it would make sense to do, and which I think in 2015 everyone would have agreed you should do if they had like known that something like that would happen. But then it did happen, and it was like one news cycle. We're very busy. There's lots of other stuff to think about. Nobody had it in mind as their red line. So it was kind of just like, wow, that's a cool paper.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think it is worth kind of trying to not get frog boiled by thinking ahead, thinking like, what is something you, even if you buy none of this, even if you think I'm completely wrong, what is something you would observe that would make you go, oh, okay, I'm worried now. We should have some kind of agreement. And then if that does happen, like, just notice. Don't, like, let yourself just get frog-boiled until, like, AIs are have all positions of power and decision-making, and you're just like, yeah, I mean, Congress had an approval rating of 14%. Like, it can't be worse, right? Because I can't imagine people really just letting stuff get really, really far mm-hmm. without at any point being like, what? The exception to that, I think there might be a massive AI backlash. But if there is, it's not going to be because it is be more pervasively powerful. It's going to be because it's going to take all our jobs. And that might turn people full, like, machine-smashing Luddite. And I don't blame them, because it is inherently pretty scary to have somebody, like, automate away the way that you, like, can afford to survive in our society. But that is the, like, maybe people will turn on AI soon, but if they are, it's not going to be over this. It is going to be over the AI taking their jobs.
I want to ask you about the politics of this in China. I don't know how much of this you've looked into, but, like, obviously in the United States, it's, like, pretty clear, like, there are, like, these lines drawn between, you know, groups who are very pro-accelerating the technological development of AI. They view it largely as, this is a big step, like the internet, mm-hmm. but it's a normal technology. It's and not it, something that's like yeah. we need to think of as such a massive paradigm shift that it would require like this kind of nuclear proliferation type treaties. And those folks are kind of just like folks like Mark Andreessen or other yeah, folks yeah. at these big, you know, Silicon Valley venture capital firms who are excited about the potential for AI to make them billions and billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And then there's folks like you who are like concerned about this and not working in AI and who are trying to raise the alarm about it. And there's a lot of diversity among those yeah, sets yeah. of people, as you mentioned. But I'm like curious, because to me, like, I mean, this is a very America-based conversation, but like the big other player yes. here is China. What is the conversation like there?
It's a really good question. I don't have as good an answer as I would like to, and it is absurd to me that we don't have a lot more China-specific journalists on this topic. Mm-hmm. Like, it is really important. I am, you know, everything I read from China is inherently coming through. Like, you can use the LLMs for literal translation, but not for like cultural translation and stuff like that. I have heard a lot of claims, and it's very hard to know how to weigh them. Claims I'm relatively confident in include China very much wants to get as many chips as they can. And it does not make any sense if from a perspective of America's geopolitical interests to sell them chips. Like, if you have any race-related concerns whatsoever, keeping all the chips is just clearly a good idea. Sometimes people will be like, well, if we give them chips, maybe they won't be motivated to develop their own chips. And I think this is bonkers. They are extremely motivated to develop their own chips and are doing it as fast as they can.
But they are doing it in large part as a reaction to the fact that we kept trying to take away our chips. chips from them.
Plausibly, but also China's industrial policy has been do as much as we can at home for a really long time. It's a little hard to imagine.
We saw the acceleration after the first
conference. I think that's fair. They sped up after we enacted chips. But at this point, I think selling them chips would be a mistake. So that's like one place where I have a pretty strong take. I don't think that they think it's going to destroy the world. I think that they wouldn't be building AI if they thought it was going to destroy the world. I think that, like,
I don't know. There are people here who are doing
that. There are people here who are doing that. I think that is sort of a weird output of some, like, very specific dynamics here. I think my impression is that they mostly, I haven't seen, and maybe I wouldn't, because maybe they would be less public about something that's more like a political opinion or whatever. I don't think it is a common belief that you're gambling with those kind of stakes. I think this is an incredibly, incredibly important technology. That's obvious. And I think if you expect, like, at least a decade before crazy stuff happens, then by then they will have their own chips and, like, sort of be able to be peers in compute access, which will not happen until they have their own chips, unless we decide to sell the chips to them, which Jensen Huang is constantly, like, giving Trump a lot of money and saying, like, you don't mind if I sell chips to China, right? And it makes me very angry that we have an incredibly corrupt president. I'm also kind of angry at Jensen Huang because I think he should just stop trying to sell chips to China.
I don't understand. Like, some people, I'm like, you're rich enough. Like, is it not enough at this point?
And it's not like there aren't lots of buyers in America.
They can't even fulfill all the orders.
No, it was obviously mostly on the president for being insanely corrupt, but I am pretty mad that, So
I want to ask you another thing that's an interesting feature about the Chinese AI ecosystem is that they are largely open source models.
Yeah.
And I'm like curious about, like, I mean, obviously in some levels, like when I talk to ML researchers, they find this to be amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because researchers are just like open source anything. They're like, wow, we're all, I mean, like, it's similar to like, econ researchers putting out their preprints very early and the kind of push.
Really helpful to like the.
To learn and to develop things faster. And in most scientific areas, we're like really excited about fast development of new technologies and getting to the frontier. America doesn't do this. Most of our AI labs keep their models closed source. You can't just like, I mean, open source can be a range of things where one, where you can see all the weights yourself, or that you can just like, you know, train it yourself, but you can't see all the weights. Like, it's very different things. Yeah. So first of all, I'm just like wondering, like, open source to me indicates in some ways transparency in a way that it's easier to test, but it also maybe accelerates progress. Like, how do you think about this?
So I think that I'm glad we have open source models. I think that the share of people who care about, I want this thing to run on my own computer, I want to understand how it works, I want multinational corporations to have no role in it, they are very few, but an enormous amount of our freedom is due to them. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm very glad there are people who are really, really invested in that you should have the version of this that you can have yourself with no intermediation. And I would never want a world where the only way to interact with intelligence is, or like these extraordinary intelligences, is through a subscription to one of these companies and stuff like that. But I wouldn't want, well, okay, it wouldn't matter as much as you would think for like individual freedom if OpenAI were to open source their biggest ChatGPT, because you can't run it on your computer anyway. It would help their competitors a ton. And I think the trade secrets and competitive secrets stuff is a big part of why they haven't done it. Mm-hmm. And yes, since I am not in a hurry for us to build the smartest, bestest, fastest thing possible, I'm not exactly leaning on these companies to share more of their secrets with each other, because I think this thing is moving fast as is, and I don't necessarily want it to move faster. On the other hand, like, I think some people look at this debate and they're like, well, a lot of this stuff is kind of complicated. But if I have to choose between the people who, like, want these companies to just, like, bottle this all up themselves and dole it out to people versus, like, information should be free, I know which side of that I'm on. And I think that's a healthy, like, instinct. I'm kind of pragmatically, I'm like, hey, I'll let them have their trade secrets. I do fully, like, sympathize there.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about the partisan valence of AI regulation, because I think it's something that's actually not super intuitive to people, in part because it used to be the case the Democratic Party was the party of big tech and technological progress in general, in part because it's part of the educated class. Yeah. Those people end up being in tech, but also big tech was really kind of like this real ascendant progressive force in the Obama years in particular. Yeah. And, you know, it was close to the White House in those years. And then, of course, like the valence of that switched dramatically. But it's still kind of weird. Like, conservative parties are, you know, conservative. They don't like massive change usually. And they don't like the idea of a technological giant. And as we've talked, and we'll link to Kelsey's article about this in the show notes, these models, because they are trained on the corpus of human language, largely books, articles, they're quite lived out. Like, you ask, I mean, you did this great piece where you asked AI in different languages these questions about various values, and you got, like, across, like, DeepSeek and OpenAI and ChatGPT and Gemini and all these different models, the similar answers about, like, you know, you shouldn't beat your wife. Like, you know, if your kid comes out as gay, like, you shouldn't hate him. Like, things like this, which are, like, very normal maybe in the Western liberal democracies, but are not normal in many of the countries and languages that you were talking to these AI chatbots in. But setting that aside, I mean, like, what I've largely observed, and I'm not following this as closely as you are, is that the Republican Party has been much more, at least the Trump White House, has been much more pro-AI and trying to accelerate AI progress. And, you know, there's been pushes to help, you know, expand data centers in the states, because they've been telling states this is a priority for us. We want these to be permitted. We want these to be allowed. And it's just had this much more in favor of AI vibe, in part because it seems like there's been an overlap between the tech right and the White House. And I don't know, I'm not fully sure where the Democratic Party is on this yet. Like, obviously there was an attempt in the Biden administration to do some sorts of, like, frameworks and regulations for it, and that was repealed by Trump when he came into office. But at the same time, too, you have this kind of, like, scattershot at the state level of, like, attempts to regulate, and Gavin Newsom doesn't sign at the last minute. Anyway, so I'm hoping you can walk us through it. Like, what does the partisan landscape look like here?
I think this is a product of, like, America's two political parties, like, compressing a bunch of different things that don't necessarily go together at all. Because, like you said, yeah, the conservative party, you might think, would not want to, like, completely upend all
of human civilization
overnight, but they are also, like, historically the, like, more regulation skeptical small government party. And I think some of the opposition to AI regulation is coming from that, like, traditional, like, usually when the government regulates, then we get, you can't have a single stair apartment building, and then no one can afford where to live, and then, like, that's a catastrophe for your civilization. In the same spirit, if you, like, give a cartel too much power over how many doctors you have, you don't have enough doctors, healthcare is unaffordable, catastrophe for your civilization, maybe we should just, like, lay off. I have some sympathy for the deregulate people. I think that in the case of AI, there's some, like, really high stakes and we should have smart regulation. But I do have some sympathy for the people who are just like, okay, but the last 10 times we just, like, impoverished ourselves for no reason, or for a reason that did not justify it.
Particularly, I think, I mean, like, I talked about this on our episode with Jasmine Sun, but, like, particularly on our podcast with Jasmine Sun, we talked about how regulations on tech companies to prevent them from innovating is something that's, like, a lot of tech companies, a lot of tech CEOs and VCs, they're mostly, like, they're not super prickly about having to pay taxes. They're really annoyed when your regulations impact their ability to innovate, or for new startups to come up and, like, try new things.
And for the most part, I think they are right to be, because I think that most of the ways that the world is wealthier and better from the perspective of of liberal values than it was a couple hundred years ago is because of invention, because we have cures for more diseases, we have more material goods, we have more ability to communicate and stuff like that. I'm very much on team let innovation happen. With, this exception where I'm like, no, not. I don't think that you should, like, take these AIs that you know are sometimes acting in these dangerous and adversarial ways and just make them way smarter and more capable without any kind of, like, plan for how that's going to go well. I don't think you should do that. But so there's the deregulation thing. Then there is, like, China hawkishness, which I think is also kind of oddly divided between the parties right now. Like, the Republican Party used to be more generally on a hawkish footing or whatever, but you've got a lot of isolationists, and you've got a lot of these days of, like, let's, like, split the hemispheres. That's, like, a great plan, right?
So no one's tried this one before.
Yeah.
Just split up the world. No problems.
So you've got that. You've got the, like, very aggressive Andreessen contingent, which has, like, aligned itself with the Trump administration, and I think thought in exchange they were going to get lots of, like, great pro-business stuff. As far as I can tell, they are hated by everyone else in the Trump coalition. Like, they're just held in complete contempt. And, like, the rest of the Trump coalition is quite populist. It's not enthused about AI, not enthused about corporations, not enthused about like a hawkish policy with regards to China.
And particularly they don't like the transhumanism of AI.
No, yeah. they don't like the transhumanism. They don't like the futurism. So you've had all of these coalitional clashes. In my view, the tech right has lost most of them. Mm-hmm. Like many of the things that they went in, like, oh, well, yeah, shame about like, you know, the PEPFAR and everything, but we're going to get this thing. They're not getting that thing over and over again. We're going to get like removal of childhood vaccines, and we're going to get cancellation of some of the best stuff the government does. We're going to get insanely high tariffs and insanely high prices and a disaster.
This is why I feel like it's weird to me there's not been more soul searching. Well, not weird. I'm frustrated that there has not been more soul searching by people who said they were doing this because they were tech progress focused, and they're like, we have to ally the Trump administration because the Democrats were anti-progress, and at least Trump will be pro-. And I'm like, sorry, the biggest outcomes of this administration will be on immigration and on tariffs. The most degrowth policies that have been passed Trump has in been ages.
Catastrophic for, if you cared about industrial policy, worst outcomes you could have gotten on every front. And there hasn't been, certainly hasn't been public soul searching. Mm-hmm. I think there hasn't been private either. My guess is that a lot of these people, like, you know, they can give an economics-based account of why they did it or whatever. But for a lot of people, voting is an emotional and affiliative thing. And they were really mad at the Democrats. The Democrats really screwed up. The Democrats did really screw up. And they were like, we hate those Democrats. And then, you know, the fact that none of the things Trump would said would happen. You've seen a couple people say, okay, I've been disappointed. This isn't what I wanted. And I'm thinking about what to do differently. But I think for a lot of people, you know, the reasons they gave you turn out not to have been their real, what it was about. And, you know, many, many cases of that to go around. But yeah. The tech right has mostly not gotten what they wanted. In fact, they most recently bid for another moratorium, or like, they want to not allow states to impose any AI regulations. They have pushed really aggressively for this. It's not happening. It's not happening because Republican senators basically don't want to do this. They're hearing from their base. They don't like it.
Is something where like, the principled argument that there should be one regulatory framework for AI across the whole country seems correct. Yeah. But given that no one is attempting to pass
a regulatory
framework, then it's sort of like, well, yeah, like perhaps Utah should get to pass its own. You're not doing it.
Exactly. I have no issue with the federal government preempting state regulation by passing a federal regulatory framework and then saying our federal regulatory framework preempts your state one. But if they're just like, we're asleep at the wheel, we have no plan, we actually like can barely agree to continue funding the government at extant levels this year, but you're not allowed to do anything either because like it makes us jealous, like that's not as compelling a pitch to me. And also I think the case that the states are strangling AI is really, really overstated. I think California, which does not have like the best political philosophy or anything.
Famously.
I complain about my state's governance all the time, but California has taken pretty seriously that it is both morally important to have like good economic growth stuff come out of AI, and that there are some really serious and scary like downsides to AI, and that there's a lot of demand right now for oversight just on things like if you say to a chatbot, I'm a 15-year-old and I want to kill myself, would this noose design work? Like, what does it say in response? You know, I think California has actually done like a tolerable job, like solid B minus. Oh, with the great inflation these days, solid A minus on, you know, walking those lines.
That took me a second.
Kelsey. And It is not the case that we are currently crushing AI, as you can tell from the fact that, like, in the last week, each of the major AI companies have come out with their newest, latest, and greatest. You know, I would have expected the moment where we have, like, trivial, at-your-fingers, perfect deepfakes with no distinguishing marks would have been, like, a huge transformative moment. I actually feel like it kind of just blew past people because they're used to it now. But the newest Google model, the Gemini 3 Nano Banana, also, why do we call these things? it's so they can humiliate us. Yes. So they can make us say, Gemini Nano Banana. it's perfect. You cannot tell the difference between a picture generated with it and a real picture. We can't trust pictures anymore. The era where pictures meant something is just over. Without like the ability to like verify their provenance and chain of custody and all of that stuff. But like in terms of pictures you see on the internet, we just will never know anymore.
So, I mean, neither of us are like reflexively, clearly from this conversation, just pro all tech. But I do think that like in general, we're very pro tech people. And this has been a very like doomer conversation. So I want to bring us to a place where both of you and I are extremely excited about AI technology, which is on self-driving cars and autonomous vehicles. And this is a place where like we now know with like a pretty good degree of certainty that you're going to have like tens of thousands of lives saved a year if you were to switch vehicles, all vehicles on the road over to autonomous vehicles. Obviously, no time soon are we going to switch over all vehicles on the road, but even switching over a good number of them would reduce the number of accidents, particularly fatal accidents,
by a lot.
Yeah. And this is a huge problem in cities, obviously, but also just like in general, time savings of like, you don't have to be in the car paying attention on the road. You can just sit in the back with your kid and like go over his homework with him, or like you can sit with your partner and like unplug after a long day. Like there are lots of ways in which it's going to make people's lives better and give them back time. But people are not as excited as you and I about autonomous vehicles. We did a poll. We'll also link that in the show notes. Like, why do you think that is?
So I think that some of it is like people projecting the stuff from the rest of the AI debate we've discussed. I think a lot of people don't see the benefits of these chatbots, and they do see like the erosion of a bunch of things we used to be able to count on in terms of like articles that are worse and AI written and full of nonsense. And I think sometimes people project their resentment of everything to do with AI onto the Waymos. And the Waymos are great. Waymos are far more popular in the cities where they exist than in the cities that haven't seen them. So I'm not super worried about public sentiment here, because as long as people who see a Waymo are then like, oh, this is actually great, then, you know, they can just expand.
Well, the thing that worries me is that before Waymos get in, cities will ban them. I mean, we're seeing this conversations at least happening in places like Boston. Even here in DC, there's been these concerns that, like, you know, we can preemptively stop these from entering. Like DC, we have like Waymos driving around. They're not picking up passengers, and there's always a driver in the car, but they're practicing and they're learning the streets and they're making sure that things are okay and there aren't these like, you know, major accidents or whatever. But like the goal, and I'm so excited, is that there will be autonomous vehicles here in DC, and like we will take them. But like, I am worried that you could end up getting a situation where like the best versions of AI are like choked by regulation, whether it's Waymos or it's stuff that has to do with medical care, because people are really worried about AI in medicine, or it's going to be in the places that actually impact the physical landscape, because that's where people are, there are their most regulations, versus military, which just gets to do whatever it wants without really much oversight. And so like, I mean, I don't know, are you bullish on Waymo?
I am bullish on Waymo. I think that the people who are driving like Boston considering banning Waymos or ever, it's a small number of people. City politics always comes down to such a small number of people. You just need a small number of people who are upset at the deaths of our loved ones by careless driving accidents, because this affects so many people. Like, a lot of people, you know, have lost a loved one, often at a like unfathomably young age. Like, whole families still get wiped out by like a drunk driver cross the road in the middle of the night and stuff like that. This is one of those things where I'm kind of like, if this was intentionally done by a terrorist, then we would like change everything about our society. Like 30,000
people a year.
Yeah, yeah. But it's like, you know, we think of it as unavoidable, and so we don't think about it at all, but it's avoidable now, and it should be taken much more seriously. So I think the thing...
And there's a reason why Mothers Against Drunk Driving is one of the biggest proponents of autonomous vehicles.
Because Mothers Against Drunk Driving is focused on the goal of not having our loved ones die pointlessly. And autonomous vehicles are great for the goal of not having our loved ones die pointlessly. But yeah, my advice to listeners or whatever is, quite seriously, the amount of effort that makes the difference between whether, say, Boston allows or bans Waymos is probably pretty small. Like, set up a Twitter, and every time a human driver kills someone in Boston, like, post about it and tag all of the Congresspurse people and go like, this death is because you don't allow self-driving cars, which are safer in our city. This would not have happened with a self-driving car and it's your fault. Like, that would probably be all it takes. You know, like, I think that would be sufficient. Somebody man the Boston.
I do feel like AI could also do this quite easily.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Use the self-driving, use the ChatGPT AI to fight for the AI that will actually save lives against the regulatory environment that wants to stop it. But like, there was a San Francisco assembly member or city council member mm-hmm. or whatever who a Waymo tragically ran over a cat mm-hmm. And immediately
was it Kit? What was the name of the cat? The
cat was named Kit Kat.
Yeah.
Immediately someone ran the data and determined that Waymos are far less likely to hit cats than human drivers. Mm-hmm. So even if you are a single issue cats getting run over by cars voter,
you're pro Waymo.
But they made a big fuss you know, about how justice for Kit Kat, we have to get Waymos off the streets. But I think people mostly just rolled their eyes, because once you have Waymos in your city, it's really clear they are safe drivers. They are a lot of fun to ride in. They are kind of cute. They're like, it feels like the ideal of having robots in our society. They're here to help, and they do so by making our lives safer and better and stuff like that. So I think as long as people see Waymo, and it might even be enough for people to travel to cities that have widespread Waymo, then they'll go, oh, now, okay, I'm on board with this one. Like, people have a fair bit of ability to evaluate stuff for themselves and be for the good. The other thing I see some people say is like, well, I'm a transit advocate, so I don't want driving to get more convenient because I would like it if people wouldn't be using single occupancy
vehicles. Because it's possible that like with widespread AV adoption, what you actually get is that it becomes cheaper, both in terms of your own physical own cost, but also in terms of so it becomes cheaper for you to be able to go further out into the exurbs to buy a house. So you get a bigger house and you don't have to drive anymore. So your time isn't taken up and you don't have to spend money on a car. It's an autonomous vehicle. So it's probably cheaper on average over the course of your life for transportation. And so then you get like all of this sprawl. And on top of that, you reduce the pressure for people to take trains and buses, and then you take up a lot of the roads with these kinds of things too. So I hear those concerns.
Yeah. No, I think it's a real worry. And I think during the conversation about schools, we talked about how I just trying to convince people to do something against their own interests because they like owe it to the broader society works way better if you're offering them something appealing. And I think ultimately I use transit all the time. I live in the Bay. I don't own a car. I wouldn't own a car if I could own an autonomous car, although I would probably like call the autonomous car sometimes. But you need transit to be reliable and safe and clean and frequent. And if it is, then it is always going to beat cars for many trips in dense areas. And a lot of people will choose to live in dense areas if you build houses for them. Mm-hmm. So if your goal is dense transit-based communities, you really absolutely have to solve those dense communities having places for people to live, and they will live there. You do not have to worry that you will build the apartment buildings and they won't come. They will come if they have the apartment buildings. And then, yeah, transit has to be safe and reliable. And I wish people would focus more on safe and reliable and frequent and somewhat less on free, because I have never like not gone on the BART because it's going to cost me $4, but I have frequently not gone on the BART because it is a time of night when I'm nervous about going to that station or getting off at that stop or stuff like that. You know, you don't want your life to be controlled by fear, but it is a good idea to like be mindful of like, is there going to be anyone else on the train at that hour?
Yeah.
And if you have to think about that for the train and you don't have to think about that for a car, then for a lot of people, that is a huge argument in favor of the car.
Yeah, I mean, like, you just missed the stress.
Yeah.
Even if nothing was going to happen.
Yeah. Like, I think that we will continue to have dense transit-oriented cities where the main barrier to people living in the dense transit-oriented cities is that we will not build houses for them. I do think that the cars might enable a lot of sprawl, and that is unfortunate. But the way to fix it is to build housing, not to like try and artificially make cars worse and deadlier.
Well, I think that's a good place to close. Kelsey, always our last question. What is an argument you've come across recently that you would like to argue against?
Okay, so in the world of AI and writing, you know, obviously as a journalist, I have a vested interest in writing continuing to be done by people, but we are seeing more and more of it be taken up by AI. Recently, there was a big viral post. It was on Substack. The Free Press ran it as an opinion piece. It was like, the poverty line should really be $140,000. It was AI written. I read through it. I noticed a bunch of like signs of AI style writing. And also I looked up a bunch of the facts in it and they were wrong, which like is sometimes a bit of a giveaway that an article is AI. I said this to the author and he was like, yes, I use AI for writing my articles. It's a productivity tool. And if we want productivity increases, we should embrace such productivity tools.
Humiliating.
And I don't, I'm all in favor. I use AI to enhance my productivity. I do things like paste a PDF into it and say like, are these five statistics correct? Yeah. Or I say like some of my most recent chats are like, come up with an effect size estimate for the Texas fake miracle. So I can compare it to this paper on the effect size we're claiming in Mississippi. And it find me a paper estimating the effect size for Texas. I can't do that with Google search. I simultaneously try to do it with Google search and it is much faster and more reliable at coming up with the right thing. Or, you know, I remember somebody saying this, can you look through all my notes and find who said it to me? It's so useful for that, but I would never use it to write. And when people do use it to write, you end up with this awful situation where an argument has all of these superficial signifiers of somebody thought hard about this. They worked hard to distill their ideas into prose. This is worth your time to read. But in fact, it is not worth your time to read. Nobody thought hard about it. None of the ideas in it have any distillation. You will basically read through the whole thing and then just be deeply confused because none of the like things in it went together. In the case of this guy's article, an enormous number of like economists and public policy people had to spend tons and tons of their time like writing a response to explain why all of the approach he had used made no sense and the results made
why $140,000 a year is not the right poverty line.
And so a productivity tool, it is a tool for like causing us to have discourse about your ideas, which is an anti-productivity tool. If you didn't think the ideas through at all and they make no sense and your piece is full of errors and now a lot of humans have to spend a lot of their time rebutting it. Like, I think it was a good thing that there used to be a correlation between the quality of the ideas and the quality of the writing. That was a useful correlation and it doesn't exist anymore and I miss it.
I have a slight hope that like we're at this weird place right now where people who have built up some level of expertise or thinking in whether it's writing or finance or policy analysis or you know whatever this guy does. I think he's a
hedge fund.
He's hedge fund or something like that. And you know, if you have a bunch of expertise, you can use AI to like fake your way through a lot of stuff. But like if you stop thinking for like 10 to 15 years, like, you know what I mean? Like, you stop using your brain, like, and it basically, you become indistinguishable from AI in general. Like, I just actually do think that, like, there will be comparative advantage for people who are thinking, because I think there's, like, just a creativity benefit. And this is my hope. I think that it's possible that AI will get so good that it'll be able to iterate and, like, it'll have all the ideas that I have as well, even if I spent all my time reading and thinking and talking with smart people. But I just think that, like, at least you can hedge against that happening to you. And I think people like this guy, like, yes, he got notoriety for a day. A lot of people on the internet, like, followed his blog and, like, will think he's interesting. But, like, in terms of influencing policy, he's actually like downgraded his ability to do so because most people in this space are just like, you got panned from everyone from the far right to like AEI, it's a conservative institution, to like the far left. Like everyone thinks you're a moron now. And like he was someone who I think was not, I don't know, like well respected, but he was like in the intellectual community on finance Twitter. And it's just like, is that something people care about anymore? Like, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, we will see. There's lots of these changes where I'm like, if it happens slowly enough, I have like great faith in our ability to like ultimately work something out. If it's all happening too fast, I do worry that like before we can arrive at functional equilibria, like everything's gone. But, you know,
we'll see. On that doomy note, Kelsey, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you. Good to see you.